Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:10 p.m. this Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 6th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off this week with silver, and it rallied spectacularly in the early part of the week and gave up almost all the advance for this week in the last 2 days. Well, this is schooling anyone who is a newcomer to precious metals that they are volatile and that these explosive moves on the upside are followed by even more abrupt pullbacks. That's one of the hallmarks of precious metals. They can be extraordinarily volatile. When they complete base formations, they tend to go on spectacular runs on the upside. But when those runs expire, then people tend to get out rather quickly. In fact, it's one of the reasons why people get invested in precious metals, is because when they break out, they really, really go. And silver is a great example of that. As recently as the beginning of June or the end of May, it was trading around 14 and a quarter, and on Wednesday of this week, it was over 19 and a half. So that's a very impressive percentage move in just a very short period of time. But when we look at this on a longer term basis, we can see that there is plenty of lateral resistance around the $20 area. And I think it's understandable that people might be a little reticent about paying $20 plus for silver when it's failed at this level on a number of occasions previously. The $20 area had been, well, I guess to be more accurate, it was probably more like the $18 area back in 2013 and 14, represented an area of support. $20 represented resistance in 2016, and now we're seeing the first evidence of resistance around the $19 area in here at the moment. The most important thing that silver has done has been to break the downtrend. One of the catalysts, I believe, for the spectacular run that we've had in platinum this week and over the course of the last few months has been the fact that it broke its downtrend against gold. And I know that this gold silver-gold ratio is often looked at the other way around, but I think it's important to show silver's turn to outperformance. It underperformed in pretty spectacular fashion all the way from the peak in 2016. You can see that during that period in 2016, when precious metal miners were really quite undervalued and people started to think of them as an asset class that had scope for a significant rally, that we had a very big move in precious metals and in the mining complex. Silver then took off. What I think is also particularly interesting is that it doesn't matter how much history you look at, the way that David used to describe silver as high beta gold is true. That if you look at the beta function on Bloomberg, it has about a beta of 1.36 for as far back as one might think to look. Now, when we think about why is it that precious metals are pulling back, you're going to see a lot of rationalization. You're going to see a lot of people saying that this is just it's because of Jay Powell, it's because of China or the trade war, it's because of the potential that the economy is not going to go into recession, or that the total of bonds internationally with negative yields is about to contract, and it has contracted over the course of this week. It's back below 16 billion now. It's only 15.6 trillion. And this does suggest that we are at a point here where some of the betting on perpetual deflation is beginning to erode. When you have Jay Powell speaking in Switzerland and last month and saying that the Federal Reserve will do whatever is required to avoid a recession, then we have to take him seriously. I remember it was back when Mario Draghi made the whatever it takes statement that the market started to turn. And everybody now looks back on that date as being a catalyst. But at the time, people didn't really believe it. They wanted to see evidence. And I think it's a similar situation that we're seeing right now with the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has said they're going to do whatever it takes to avoid a recession. And that means that they're certainly going to cut interest rates in September, and it is likely they're going to continue to cut interest rates until they see growth starting to stabilize, and I think that's an important factor. Then, of course, we have the ECB, and they're going to be making a decision next week about what to do with monetary policy. The market has priced in the potential that they're going to go for negative interest rates. A number of ECB board members have been standing up this week and saying they don't think it is advisable to continue to buy bonds. But if the ECB isn't going to buy bonds and they do need to provide stimulus, well, what are they going to do? Well, they're potentially going to go for negative rates. And that obviously has a deleterious effect on the banking sector. When we look at the European banks, though, they are starting to rally. And what that is beginning to think to suggest, I think, is that we are at the point where there is a great deal of pessimism about the outlook for global growth. Then let's take a look at some of the stock markets like Korea, which has sold off aggressively over the course of the last 18 months, but it was bouncing in here this week. Then let's look at the S&P 500, and this is an index that has firmed impressively from the region of the trend mean. And I think one of the most important things it's done has been to post this large upside key reversal in June from the region of the trend mean. When we zoom out and think about this index over the course of the bull market to date, there have been three 18-month consolidations. There is absolutely no doubt that this one has been somewhat more volatile. But one of the other points that I think is worth considering is that a 200-week moving average, or that would equate to a 1,000-day moving average, has been a reliable buying signal over the course of the last decade. Every time we've had a severe medium-term correction and there have been fears about a recession, then the market has found support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. This is one of the primary trend consistencies of this bull market to date. I think that's an important point. So when we think about what exactly is going on here, then that does suggest that we are at a point where there is a significant quantity of stimulus about to hit the market. Then we also know that there is a wall of cash that's sitting on the sidelines, the quantity of money that has been raised as a result of selling pressure, particularly at the end of last year, has been just sitting there. It's been sitting in money market accounts. It's been doing really very well because of the phenomenal bull trend in government bonds generally. When we think about the treasury yield, it is now around 1.5%, but it was at 3.25% at the end of last year. And we have been pricing in the potential for perpetual deflation over the course of the last 6 months. So that's an important, I think, one of the more important points. There is an exaggeration in terms of the arguments that are going around right now. And we've had a very persistent move in terms of government bond yields. The compression in yields has been flattering to the precious metals sector. And profit taking in one is likely to lead to profit taking in the other. There is, I think, one of the most important points about precious metals is that their allure is bolstered, and gold in particular is burnished by the comparison with government bonds when yields are declining. And that's certainly what has been one of the motivating factors behind investors getting into gold over the course of the last 6 months. But the determination of central banks to avoid a recession, that's potentially more important, because what we're looking at is increasingly the willingness of so-called independent central banks to I think marry their policy with governments, and there is a determination by governments to try and avoid the collapses in their parties that they fear as a result of the rise of populism. So they're trying to spend their way out of trouble, and that is being facilitated by central bankers. The one thing that nobody is worried about right now is inflation, and the bond market certainly doesn't exhibit any fear of deflation, but those yields are in the region of areas where we have seen significant moves previously. It does suggest that bonds are really very overbought. Now, I thought this graphic was really quite interesting, and it is the it gives us the hourly earnings chart, and that has been trending higher. But then it also overlays that with the difficulty in finding workers, which has been trending higher in a much more aggressive manner, and that is likely to put upward pressure on the hourly wage. There are currently 47,000 retail workers at the major supermarket chains in California about to go on strike for higher wages. Well, I was talking with one of my friends during the week who has a garment manufacturing business, and he was talking about someone who's been his assistant for the last 10 years, who was making about $3 more than minimum wage. Well, because of the move higher in minimum wages, where they're expected to reach $15 by the beginning of next year, that obviously erodes the margin for the people that were making more than minimum wage previously. And of course, that is also one of the motivating factors behind all of these retail workers, or I guess supermarket workers, looking for higher wages, because there is nobody wants to think of themselves as a minimum wage worker. And when the minimum wage rises, then that puts upward pressure right across the spectrum. Not only does it create wage demands, but it also creates inflationary pressures because of the tightness in the economy generally. It creates more demand because people have more money to spend, and therefore prices rise. And that's a pretty simple transmission mechanism for inflation. With the fiscal stimulus that is currently going on, as well as the potential for lower interest rates and a kickstart once more to quantitative easing, then that does have the potential to act as an inflationary measure. One thing that I think is worth highlighting, though, is the strength of the dollar has been an inhibiting factor in that transmission of liquidity to the economy. When we look at the total assets of central banks, they're still around 19.3 trillion. And that is pretty close to the lows put in at the beginning of this year. So the strength of the dollar, the unwillingness of the ECB to persist with quantitative easing, the fact that the Bank of Japan has been less than enthusiastic about extending its quantitative easing, and the fact that China is for the moment concentrating on bank reserve requirements and the and fiscal stimulus, that's weighing on the the fact that are weighing on the total assets of central banks. Then we have the additional fact that the US Federal Reserve's balance sheet has continued to contract. And that is, I think, quite surprising for the vast majority of people, because everyone was anticipating that once they stopped reducing the size of their balance sheet, that it would immediately start to increase just to provide the requisite quantity of liquidity into the economy. And that has not occurred. Part of the reason for that might be an unwillingness to give President Trump what he wants. There may also be the fact that because interest rates are so low that they're getting more prepayments on their mortgage portfolio. The one thing that we also know is that there's going to be a massive quantity of debt issued. Just this week, we had major corporations issuing long-dated debt, Apple issuing a 30-year bond for approximately 2.4%, if my memory serves. That's a complete no-brainer. These companies should be taking advantage of extraordinarily low interest rates to borrow money, and particularly if that is going to be put to productive purposes. But if it is just simply paying down old debt at rates that haven't been this attractive for at least 2.5 years, then there is certainly a rationale for it. And of course, that is also what the consumer is doing. There is ample scope for refinancing around these levels. We haven't seen mortgage rates this low in really quite some time. These are all stimulative measures. Then when we think about how do we measure the deficit spending that is going on, well, I compiled this chart of all of the deficits that the major countries are running, and it's currently sitting around $850 billion. And that's about as high as it has been over the course of the last 8 years. So there is potential for this to go higher. The US has already committed itself to an additional $1.2 trillion stimulus. There is the potential for China to continue to run its stimulus. There is also scope for Europe to provide the same kind of stimulus. So when we start to put all of these things together, where we have $19.3 trillion in terms of the quantity of assets that are sitting on central banks, then there is the additional $850 billion. Well, then you start to add the two together, you're back above $20 trillion in assets. And that does break the sequence of lower rally highs in the central bank assets chart. I think that's one of the more important points that we have seen over the course of the last year, the transition from monetary stimulus to fiscal stimulus. And what we have in front of us is the combination of the two, that governments and central banks are going to be much more closely interrelated. Now, that's a reason why gold is in a new bull market. That is the primary rationale for why one would want to own gold, because there is this clear potential for that to result in an inflationary bias. And then, of course, you have the uncertainty, and there is the obvious correlation with modern monetary theory that it is going to boost asset prices. And of course, that is why we're continuing to see the strength in the primary Wall Street indices. What I found particularly interesting in here today is that despite the fact that a number of states are opening antitrust suits against Facebook, it was only down $3. And this does not look like the kind of dynamic move that we know the share is capable of. Then I also continue to think that Amazon is one of the most reliable barometers for the health of this bull market, and it is firming from the region of its 200-day moving average. I think the fact that we have had a succession of ranges, one above another, and that the fact that this one is just somewhat larger and perhaps a little bit lengthier than the others. That is still fuel for the buy the dips strategy working for Amazon. And considering the fact that Amazon is completely dependent on the consumer, and particularly the US consumer, then its ability to continue to find support in the region of the trend mean, I think that is one of the going to be one of the more important points to monitor. I'm going to post an article in here today from profiling Samsung and what they think living in the world of 2069 is going to be like, or 2169. So, sorry, 2069, I'm getting ahead of myself. What they're thinking about is autonomous vehicles. They're talking about them being de rigueur at the time, flying taxis. But I think the more important point, when we think about what is likely to happen in terms of the global economy over the course of the next 50 years, then any prognostications we make today obviously have to be done with some humility that they are likely to be incorrect. But one thing that we do know is that the birth rate internationally has peaked. The vast majority of people that are going to be born in the next 20 years are going to be in Africa, and that today life is cheap. And when the global population peaks in approximately 30 years' time, then that's when each life becomes progressively more valuable. It's a simple limited supply argument. And I believe that that is then when we get a true move in terms of automation. That's when there will be a very clear incentive to maximize the productive and consumption capacity of every individual in order to sustain the global economy. Because at that point, there will no longer be anywhere to export manufacturing to. Considering that that is an easily predictable argument, it's something that Jack Ma and Elon Musk were touching on this week. Well, that does suggest that it will be fully priced in before it happens. That's simply how markets work. That suggests that technological innovation is going to continue to be a very significant factor in the rise of markets. And I think that's one of the more important points that we have to consider, that the role of technology in the global economy is only going to increase. And it's likely to be, if we think about the future rather than what we've already seen, the enabling technologies like 5G are already being rolled out. Genetic sequencing is another enabling technology, and the genetic editing and genetic sequencing together are likely to coalesce into a completely new way of thinking about healthcare. Fusion energy is getting an increasingly large amount of investment capital, and I do believe that it is only a matter of time that we get positive net energy. After that, the question will be about commercialization. But positive net energy is something that is going to be transformative for the outlook for the energy sector. When we think about oil prices, then oil started to perform in here this week. It has been able to put in three consecutive days on the upside. It hasn't quite been able to break the sequence of lower rally highs just yet. But I do think we're overdue an inflation scare, particularly in view of the fact that we are in a period of time where there is a great deal of stimulus getting thrown at the economy, and central banks are desperate for inflation. They haven't seen any evidence of it, so they are throwing everything they've got at it. And oil prices are starting to steady. Copper prices are also starting to steady. We saw that in here this week, copper bounced from the $2.50 area and followed through on the upside yesterday to break the sequence of lower rally highs. So that's at least near-term support in the region of the lower side of this range. Nickel prices have also been doing better. Now, there is some consolidation underway, and it has had a spectacular rally over the course of the last 10 to 12 weeks. So there is likely to be some consolidation, but this does look like a recovery situation. Even some of the most oversold of the industrial resources, like tin, have also started to rally in here, and it's had a very spectacular upside, upward dynamic in here this week. Then when we think about the Baltic Dry Index, the fact that it is rallying in a very forthright manner and has persisted in that move despite the volatility that we've seen on other asset classes like bonds and precious metals in here this week, that's suggestive of limited supply. And I do think this is all down to the IMO 2020 regulations coming in January. So there are a number of ships that are getting taken offline as a result of that. And particularly with older ships, the cost of installing scrubbers on the emissions exceeds the values of the ships. So that is putting upward pressure on shipping rates at exactly the same time that we're getting trade tariffs imposed upon their goods. So that's a double whammy. And that is something that is going to start to put upward pressure on consumer prices. So consumers, therefore, are going to start asking for even higher wage hikes. And this is the kind of inflationary situation that we can get in the latter stages of a bull market. So when we think about the outlook here, the one thing that nobody has been willing to talk about is inflation. And when we then think about what are the risks that are arising, the risks are inflationary, where central bankers are printing money and governments are spending money they don't have, where commodity prices are starting to rally off of really quite depressed levels. Gold has already had a big move. And we already see that the US economy in particular has got low unemployment and a very large quantity of debt that needs to be refinanced. That has got the scope for the bond investors to strike and to demand higher yields. So there is the potential that we're going to get inflation. And that's one of the bigger points, that it's not priced in. And I do think then that bonds are at particular risk here. We've had a profound move in global government bond yields, and this is something that is just unsustainable. Of course, every big bull market is based upon a contradiction. And when we think about where do the bubbles reside? Well, when we think about the total return on the 10-year treasuries, it has surged higher over the course of the last 6 months to a new high. Previously, it had been losing momentum and it reasserted on the upside in very emphatic fashion. And that has reasserted the secular bull market. It has not peaked. So there is potential that some of the bond bulls will be proven right and that eventually US treasuries will also go negative. I think the problem in that argument is that it's unlikely in the short term. and that we have very overbought conditions. There is, of course, another bubble in the private equity sector. When we start to see companies coming up for IPO that have no runway to get to profitability, then you get disappointing performances. That was certainly the case with Uber. It's also been the case with Slack, where that share has rallied yesterday but came right back down in here today. Then Lyft is another company where the runway to profitability is really quite far out. We have impending IPOs like WeWork, where the Vision Fund paid up in the last round on a valuation of $47 billion. It's likely they're going to IPO at a valuation of $20 billion. So instantly, the so-called Vision Fund is taking a more than 50% haircut. And that's following the CEO taking a paycheck of $700 million at the last funding round. So the CEO knows better than anybody how much the company is worth. And of course, the company is worth zero. These types of companies that are built on leverage, that have been able to justify spending untold quantities of money on the basis that they are gaining market share and will have profitability at some stage, that beats the argument of deploying money in the stock market or deploying money in the bond markets, where one is going to get a very narrow return. But what it paints large is the willingness of investors to speculate in order to capture a yield. And this was brought home to me most acutely at a Marcus Evans convention I was at back in May, where there was a chap I met who had been a long short manager at PIMCO, and one of his clients offered to seed a venture fund that he could manage with $200 million. And he, of course, accepted, except for the fact that he hadn't the foggiest notion how to find companies to invest in. And he'd come along to the conference to try and meet people who could help him out. And the only thing that they were wondering about was the returns. There was nobody talking about the risk. There was nobody talking about the fact that you can build a product that nobody wants. That one of the hardest things to get when you're founding a company is client number one. And that's that whole environment has been functioning very healthily because of extraordinarily low interest rates. The valuations that are being put on some of these companies are extraordinary. The fact that they forgo the opportunity to IPO over the course of the last 5 years, that was a clear example of them being greedy. Now they are rushing for IPOs. And the valuations that they're getting are going down and down. The people who made a lot of money in these companies were the people that were engaged in private equity 10 years ago. The people coming in with new money to private equity today and investing in speculative ventures like WeWork or Peloton are going to lose potentially all of their investment. At the same time, private equity companies, those that have been around for a while, are exiting in record numbers from these unicorn companies. And in addition to that, there is a record quantity of dry powder at some of the private equity companies. And they're waiting for a significant pullback to deploy that capital. So what we are definitely seeing in this bull market is that there is cash on the sidelines. There has been a significant move by private equity companies to cash out. This is very late stage activity. And when we think about the yield curve spread, it is negative, although it popped back above the 2% level, popped back above the 0% level and is at a 2 basis points right now. I think it is worth considering that when the yield curve became inverted in 1998, it did pop right back up. And then it inverted again right at the end of 1999. Now, it was at that point that we were at the top of the market. The first inversion was a warning signal, but it was a warning signal of at least 18 months, and in that time the market went up another 50%. The stock market became initially inverted in November of 2005. Then it popped back up and it became inverted again in August of 2006. But we didn't really get the problems starting to manifest themselves in the stock market until well into 2007 and 2008. And this was a type 2 top and a very rolling top that took time to form. We've just had the first warning signal. So the recession could be anything up to a year and a half out. Well, if we think about where the recession, or what is going to be the catalyst for the recession, it is likely to be the US presidential election. The stock market took off on the upside when President Trump won the election, and rightfully so, because it represented a massive quantity of cash being thrown at the stock market. The trade war is ongoing. The market has been rallying over this week because of news that the US and China have set a date to talk in October. But there is no guarantee that what they talk about is going to result in a deal. There is the potential that we're going to continue to see no deal. By the time we get around to the next election, there are going to be fears about a recession, but probably not the same fears that we have today. On the one hand, it would be that if President Trump wins, then he is going to put out all the plugs in the trade war, and that will create a recession. So that is one potential rationale. Or that Elizabeth Warren wins the election and takes a 12-gauge shotgun to the corporate sector, which of course would also be negative for the stock market. So we now have a clock ticking. But every time the yield curve has become inverted in the past, we have seen significant upside afterwards. And when we now look again at the S&P 500, it has bounced again. It is within less than 100 points of its all-time peak. So I think this is a rather significant point, that there is a clear potential that we're going to see a substantial break on the upside, and that this is going to be manifested in terms of a clear move in terms to bubbly territory. We have a bubble in bonds. We have a bubble in the private equity sector. We have aggressive valuations in the corporate sector, but I think it would be an exaggeration to say that they are in a bubble right now. There is a bubble in Chinese housing, and that has been going on for years. What I think is really worth highlighting is that Jim Chanos has been singing from this song sheet for years, and his timing was wrong, but the arguments were probably correct. China is at a point now where Xi Jinping had a speech this week saying that they need to be ready for belt tightening, that they could be having a difficult environment for the next 30 years, and are going all the way out to 21 or 2047, which would be the 100 years of Communist Party rule. And that's a pretty profound statement. It suggests that the increasing tightness in terms of regulation of the economy, of the social side of the Chinese population, that's all just a warm-up phase for what is going to have to be done in terms of crowd control if the property market eventually does start to turn down. That's why I do think that we are at a stage today which is quite similar to 1998. We had the Asian financial crisis in 1997, quickly followed by long-term capital management, and then the Russian debt default, and then the Mexican peso crisis. Well, the risks now are in Europe and in China, in Argentina and in Turkey. The quantity of US dollar denominated debt that is under pressure as a result of the continued rally in the dollar, these do represent risks, and it does also represent a haven status for US dollar denominated assets. So that's very similar to the conditions we had before the bubble really started to inflate in the USA from 1998 onwards. If we are going to have a bubble, then we do have to consider that that is the time when it is easiest to make money. We also have to remain alert to the potential that when it does eventually roll over, then some of the bearish prognostications put out by people like Howard Marks and Jeff Gundlach and Ray Dalio, then those start to become more relevant after the bubble, but probably not yet before the bubble. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.
They have to be made, I think. So, I'll check anyway, but I'm pretty sure they have to be made. What? Mm-hmm. Okay, but sure, like we have to let them dry anyway. I can't ship them now. Yeah, they're kind of butterfly bags, yeah. I'm not going to do that right away because we need to make them and let them dry. So I'm not going to process the order yet.
Okay. So